Welcome to a new episode of the Liberators Network podcast. My name is Christian Verwijs, and today's episode is all about how to prevent high-performing teams from burning out. As with all our content, and that includes this podcast, it is made possible in part by our patrons, who we are super grateful for. If you think our content is valuable, if you enjoy our in-depth content like this podcast, or the scientific research that we do, or the free content that we provide to the Agile community, you can also support us by going to patreon.com/liberators. We'd be super happy with your support. It makes it easy for us to find more time to create content such as this. But let's move on to today's episode. Enjoy! How to prevent high-performing teams from burning out. One of the best teams I've worked with was really competitive. They wanted to reach their sprint goal and they felt proud of their ability to do so. However, this frequently led to overtime, especially in the final days of the iteration. This overtime was not evenly distributed. Some people, and that included myself, tended to push on into the evenings while others wisely went home to enjoy family time and relax. The situation was unhealthy and it was stressful. Although this team did not burn out, it easily could have, or I could have burned out, or one of the other team members that pushed on into the evenings. So one of the questions that recently came up in a community meetup is, how do I prevent my high-performing team from burning out? It's an intriguing question because it starts from a very positive situation. If you've ever been part of a high-performing team, you know from experience how exhilarating it can be. But paradoxically, it's also a place where people tend to lose themselves in their work and they collapse under the strain, a little bit like I did. In this episode, I want to apply an evidence-based perspective to this question. What do we know from scientific research about high-performing teams and how they can burn people out? And what can we do to prevent that, or at least diminish the chance of it happening? When is a team high-performing? The notion of high-performing teams was initially coined by the famous Tavistock Institute in the 1950s. It reflected an increasing interest in so-called human factors of the workplace, and this included aspects such as motivation, job satisfaction, communication, but also loyalty and social identification, as well as other social needs. At the same time, the nature of work also started to shift from labor based on technical skills to knowledge work based on analytical skills. Where work was mostly organized along production lines since the Industrial Revolution, work was now increasingly organized into work groups of 5 to 30 employees, where each group was given its own goal to achieve. This was the era where teamwork as a managerial concept was born. As the 1960s progressed, organizations increasingly explored what was required for effective teamwork. A good example of this is the study by Thamhane and Willemsen in 1978. Formalized methods for project management were developed around this time to optimize coordination, governance, and communication. But at the same time, organizational psychologists started to develop theories and practices for team building and how to guarantee high team performance. Unfortunately, teamwork does not guarantee high performance. In fact, Hackman in 1989, one of the most prominent researchers in teamwork, concluded from empirical research that teams generally underperform compared to groups of people who are not a team. This is often due to organizational constraints or mistakes by managers. For example, some managers reward individuals and not the team, or teams are micromanaged or they have unclear goals, and that sort of handicaps teams from being effective. And in that case, individuals may be more effective. Hackman argues that six facts need to be true for teams to be high-performing. The first one is that the task or the goal has to be suitable for teamwork, which means that it's work that benefits from having multiple brains that work on it. The second one is that the team has clear boundaries. This means that members know that they're a part of it and who else is part of it, and it's also clear who is not a part of the team, also to the people outside the team. The third aspect is that the team needs to have a clear goal that provides direction for its work. Another fact that needs to be true for teams to be high-performing is that the structure of the team has to encourage teamwork. This means that teams should have shared norms, they should have a clear composition, and also the skills to do the work that they need to do as a team. The fifth fact is that the organizational context is designed so that teamwork is rewarded, reinforced, supported, and encouraged. And finally, teams receive help and coaching in those areas where they are ready to receive it. There are many other definitions of high-performing teams. Other models emphasize the motivation of team members, or sometimes that high-performing teams are tight-knit social structures, or that they are very stable. What is clear is that high-performing teams are capable of delivering high-quality work consistently, and that they are able to learn and adapt quickly. The cost of high performance. It's great to be part of a high-performing team, but it can also be very stressful to maintain such a high level consistently. I'll now explore several areas in which there are costs associated with high-performing teams. It doesn't mean that these are always the case, but they are risks that are more prevalent in high-performing teams. The first one has to do with individual burnout and performance. Burnout is usually described as a mix of emotional exhaustion, withdrawal, depersonalization, and a low sense of personal accomplishment. At least this is the definition that Maslach, Jackson, and Leiter proposed in 1979. Burnout is not strictly a disorder or a medical condition, but it's rather the result of enduring work-related stress. Stress is the biological response of our body to perceived and immediate stressors. It prepares our body for a fight-or-flight response by increasing the levels of cortisol in our blood and by increasing muscle tension, restricting blood flow, and throttling non-vital functions. In other words, stress makes our body ready to fight or to flee. While this was a great strategy when we still lived on the steppes and were surrounded by dangerous animals, it doesn't work so well in the modern workplace. There, social expectations from colleagues, deadlines, conflict with others, but also worries about job security, can be perceived by our body as immediate stressors all the same. This means that they have the same physical effect as standing face to face with a saber-toothed tiger, or at least something close to it. If those stressors, like deadlines, conflicts, and job worries persist, burnout accumulates over time. This is particularly true when people don't feel they can slow down, take a break, or take a leave of absence for a while to get their energy back and recharge. Eventually, burnout can lead to very severe health conditions, including heart problems, life-altering chronic exhaustion, clinical depression, and even suicide. A study among 1,500 US workers in 2021 showed that 3 in 5 employees experience elements of burnout due to stress. Burnout is something to take exceptionally seriously. Taris, in 2007, performed a meta-analysis of the relationship between burnout and objective performance. Based on 16 empirical studies, he showed that people who score high on exhaustion, which is one dimension of burnout, reported lower commitment. They were also able to perform their roles less well, and they experienced much lower customer satisfaction. So burnout is clearly harmful on the individual level, both to personal health and to business objectives. Consiglio and his colleagues in 2013 also found much higher absenteeism and sick leave among people with high levels of burnout, which is costly for employers, leaving aside for a moment all the personal ramifications of this, which are also horrible. Many studies have also shown that stressed developers make more mistakes. For example, Furuyama, Arai, and Leo showed this in 1969, but also Sonnentag and his colleagues in 1994. High-stress environments are also more likely to burn members out altogether. And that brings us to another area in which you can have costs as a high-performing team, and this has to do with team burnout and performance. In contrast to individual burnout, which we just discussed, more recently there has also emerged a notion of team burnout, for example by Urien and his colleagues in 2021. This explains why some teams seem to develop burnout collectively but not necessarily individually. For example, one empirical study of healthcare teams by Lee and his colleagues in 2014 found that 16% of the variance in individual burnout was attributable to a team-level factor, namely group cohesion. This line of research builds on research into team mental models. It argues that the members of a team individually and collectively continuously interpret their environment, the stressors and the tasks they're working on. What is a stressor for one member may not be for another, but through a process called compilation, teams may eventually develop a shared sense that they are burning out, that they are overburdened and overstressed. In turn, this makes members withdraw from teamwork and become more individualistic, as Driscoll, Salas and Johnston showed in 1999. So, what's important about this research is that it tells us that burnout contains a substantial subjective component. What is exceptionally stressful for one person may not be for another. Similarly to post-traumatic stress disorder, PTS, one person may develop deep trauma after a fearful event while another may not. In teams, these interpretations may converge over time. This subjective component may incorrectly lead people to incorrectly belittle, diminish, disregard, or discard signals from individuals or teams that they are burning out. But it really doesn't matter if the reported stressors are there objectively or not. The perception is all that matters. How can high-performing teams burn out? So what we've covered up to this point is what high-performing teams are and what burnout is, both individually and on a team level. Let's now investigate why it is that high-performing teams burn out in the first place. Unfortunately, I've not found any empirical studies that investigated specifically high-performing teams. However, we can draw from the abundance of more general research on burnout in agile teams to understand what might cause it. And I'm drawing here from Tulili, Kapiluppi and Rastogi, a study from 2023. The following factors seem most relevant to me. The first one is that the high norms for performance that make high-performing teams so successful can also create a foundation for stress and pressure, especially at times when the team or its members are distracted by other events. For example, members could face work-related events, like being part of multiple teams. That could be reorganizations or changes in team composition. But it's also possible that members experience something of a personal nature, like marital issues, mental health, illness or grief, that in one way or another distract them from their work. Examples of such high norms are we always deliver on what we promise, or we always aim to exceed expectations, but also we don't complain when it gets tough, or we don't stick to 9 to 5 hours if the work isn't done. I've certainly said one of those things at one point in my life, not knowing that it was not a great norm to set for a team. Another factor is that high-performing teams are typically close-knit socially. If you want to learn more about this, Hackman from 1978 described this in more detail, and so do Carles and De Paola in 2000. This close-knit nature is a great strength, but it can easily cause members to push beyond their personal threshold for stress because they feel it is implicitly expected of them and they don't speak up about it. High-performing teams also tend to overcommit by taking on more work than they can manage. Their success in the past may lead them to overestimate their own abilities, especially in the face of setbacks that inevitably happen. High-performing teams also tend to have a very strong social identity. This is likely a source of pride for team members. Such a social identity is a powerful contributor to their effectiveness, and in scientific research we also see that teams with strong social identities tend to be more effective. For example, Carles and De Paola in 2000 studied this. Particularly when high-performing teams have not yet experienced clear and visible failure, their first collective experience with such a failure may damage the social identity much more severely than other teams. For example, if a high-performing team suffers a serious security breach, or when one of their code areas has a serious bug that brings down the entire platform. And finally, high-performing teams can be wary of lower productivity. This may cause members to be more hesitant to take a step back when they believe that they are overburdened or have too much work to do because they feel that it is expected of them by the people outside the team not to take a step back. Even when high-performing teams have the autonomy to do so, they often don't take a step back. In short, the factors that I just described make high-performing teams successful, but it can also cause them to burn out eventually. How to prevent team burnout? So what can be done to prevent team burnout, specifically in high-performing teams? Although I was unable to find studies that investigated this specifically for high-performing teams, I will infer some recommendations based on existing research from general teamwork and agile teams in particular. The first strategy is to highlight the ability of teams to self-manage. A lack of control or low autonomy has been linked to burnout. For example, Glass and McKnight in 1969 reviewed 32 empirical studies and they found evidence for a modest effect. This means that teams that have more autonomy tend to have lower levels of burnout. And this effect is understandable. If individuals or teams don't feel they can control the amount of work and other stressors, the sense of being trapped will eventually turn into burnout. The emphasis here is on feel. High autonomy strongly contributes to the ability of teams to be high-performing. For example, we found this in our study for Weiss and Russo 2023, but also Lee and Xia in 2010. So it's often a given. However, while teams may technically have the autonomy to take a step back, take a break, or reduce their output for a while, they may not feel this is possible due to social norms or expectations that they feel others have of them, and not wanting to lose face. Just as a workaholic is often unable to stop working even though they can, teams can be workaholics in a sense too. High-performing teams can be coached to leverage their autonomy to reduce work pressure, both for the entire team as for the individual members. Here are some powerful questions that we like to ask. The first is, what is one stressful activity we can let go of as a team for a while to create a breather for ourselves? Or, if you would observe our work as a team as an outsider, what would they recommend us to do in order to reduce work pressure? And finally, what is one small change that you can easily make to slow down for a while and without requiring permission or resources you don't currently have? Deliberating structure 15% solutions is exceptionally helpful here, as it asks participants to come up with solutions that are within their control. Similarly, a liberating structure like TRIS can be very helpful with an invitation like, what are all the imaginative, creative, and devious ways in which we can ramp up our work to pressure to the point where we all break? Once a large list is generated by the team, the exercise is flipped to help teams reflect on which of those things they are already doing, if they're fully honest, or at least already moving in that direction. If you want to learn more about 15% solutions or TRIS, both liberating structures, please go to liberatingstructures.com to learn how to facilitate these very simple techniques. Strategy 2. Highlight psychological safety and encourage people to listen. As everything we've talked to before shows, internal norms about productivity and performance may drive high-performing teams to push on even when they should take it slower. Individual members may feel hesitant to speak up because they don't want to be the one who challenges the norm. Furthermore, it's also clear that team burnout results from shared sense-making in a team. This means that proper and open dialogue about stress, about stressors, and how to deal with burnout play an important role in how teams process stress together. This relates closely to the concept of psychological safety, which was popularized by Edmondson in 1999. And she defines it as a shared belief held by members of a team that the team is safe for interpersonal risk-taking. Psychological safety buffers against stress and burnout by making it possible to openly discuss it. This is something that you can read more about in Delizona from 2017. But being able to speak up may not be the same as feeling heard, as one empirical study showed, for example, Kerasi in 2022. And feeling heard may be more critical than being able to speak up. Psychological safety also appears to decrease in response to team burnout, as one initial empirical study among healthcare teams showed. This is one by Osai, Konadu, and Osai Kwame from 2022. This may cause a vicious cycle, where people feel less and less able to speak up, and thus experience more and more stress. So an evidence-based recommendation is to develop both the safety of talking about stress and burnout before it happens and to coach teams to learn how to listen to each other. Furthermore, educating teams on the signs of stress and burnout and its effects, as described in this episode, may help raise that awareness. A great way to do this is with a liberating structure called Conversation Cafe. You can learn about the full facilitation steps for this at liberatingstructures.com, but the core of this approach is that it teaches people how to listen and how to take turns. It can be used really well to discuss personal and challenging topics. And potential invitations to talk about burnout and stress could be, the first one is, share a story of a time in your work when you experienced a lot of stress. What happened to you, your body, and how you interacted with others, and what can we learn from this? Another invitation is, how can we be a high-performing team on the one hand, while also being able to slow down when we need to, so we or individual members can catch our breath? The third strategy is to create norms and work agreements on how to deal with stress specifically. Implicit or explicit norms can make high-performing teams burn out over time, as we've seen continuously throughout this episode. For example, a team can implicitly agree to engage in crunch time to reach their sprint goal, even when it means that members have to work long hours. Such norms will become stronger if they are repeated. Another example is when teams implicitly agree not to complain about stress, but carry on instead. Such norms may also be imposed outside the team, for example by management or through just the culture of the company. I mean, there are companies where it's normal for people to be in before their manager comes in or to leave the office after their manager leaves. These are norms that can induce a lot of stress. High-performing teams may come to attribute their success to such norms, which makes it harder to break them from individuals and teams alike. The first step is to make the norms about work and stress explicit. You can do this with a liberating structure like 1-2-for-all. Again, you can find the instruction on how to run a 1-2-for-all at liberatingstructures.com, but it's a really nice way to start individually and then build up your interpretation and understandings of it. A good invitation for this would be, pick a recent scenario when work was tough and you felt stressed. What seems to be true about how we deal with such scenarios and the decisions we make in them as a team? Alternatively, a perceptive coach can also make observations about areas such as how a team deals with stress, who is usually in charge, who follows, and what does the person who takes charge say or signal? They can also look for signals about stress, burnout, and pressure. How do people show they are listening, and what happens next? And coaches can also look for the cadence of a team. How does a team create space to take a breather, spend time on team building, or just slow down in general every now and then, just to catch their breath? Once norms are explicit, you can work with your team to soften them, to more effectively deal with stress. You can also add more norms through work agreements to deal specifically with stress and burnout. We've always found the following sentences useful to complete for work agreements in this area. The first is, we encourage each other to maintain a sustainable pace by. The second one is, when someone in our team experiences a lot of stress, we, and then you complete the sentence. For example, you could do a timeout and collaborate on how to proceed. And finally, we agree to frequently and openly discuss how much stress we are experiencing and how we are dealing with as a team on, and then you complete the sentence. For example, a team could agree on a scale. 1 means I have very little stress right now, and 5 means I'm totally stressed out. And just ask everyone in the team to give a number, which is usually quite easy, and based on the average, you take action. Or if there are some high scores, or even a single member with a 5 or even a 4, you decide to take a step back and slow down. And that brings us to some closing words. It is a great experience to be part of a high-performing team. At the same time, it can also be stressful to be on such a team. Because the bar is so high and the expectations so positive, these teams often struggle to slow down and catch their breath. In this podcast, I shared scientific research about high-performing teams. We also talked about individual and team burnout and what can be done to prevent it. While full prevention is impossible, burnout will happen for all sorts of reasons and it can and always will, there are evidence-based recommendations in this post to buffer teams and individuals against it. Give it a try and see how you like it. And that brings us to the end of today's episode. If you liked our content, if you liked this episode, please review it on the platform that you're listening on or share it with others. It's a great way for other people to discover our content and benefit from it. Also know that doing the research for this episode and the post on which it's based took over 31 hours. That's quite a lot of time, but we're happy to invest it because we think it's important to ground what we say in scientific evidence. If you think that's important and you want us to encourage us to create more of it, please go to patreon.com/liberators and see if you can also support us with a monthly donation. We'd be super happy with it. And of course, you can always access all our other evidence-based content, both from Patreon, but also on our Medium page, medium.com/d-liberators. Having said all this, I want to thank you for listening and taking time out of a busy day to learn something about stress and hopefully how to prevent it. Take care and see you again for the next episode. Bye-bye.